we're on the edge of something. We're sort of on the edge of where ice meets rock and where permanent winter meets fast approaching summer.
I'm skiing up a glacier in south central Alaska with Roman Dial. Roman is a writer, adventurer, and professor of biology and math at Alaska Pacific University. We're here to see and feel how climate change is impacting this place and to talk about uncertainty. But more on that in a bit.
Roman, you spent a lot of time over the years on glaciers in Alaska. What are some of the changes you've seen?
The changes I've seen on the glaciers around Alaska is one of them. The first one I noted is that they disappeared from the maps. So the maps would say that we should be walking or skiing on a glacier, but there was no ice anymore, and the glacier was way up valley.
My name's Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capisani.
And this is A Hostile Climate.
On this episode, we're talking about uncertainty.
So, Simona, for those who are just getting to know us, you and I are both environmental philosophers. I teach environmental philosophy at Alaska Pacific University, where I'm a professor, and you do the same as a professor at Durham University in the United Kingdom.
So in each episode of A Hostile Climate, we're going to use philosophy to try to understand a bit more about climate change. Today's topic is uncertainty. So, Alex, how does uncertainty relate to climate change?
Well, climate change is an uncertain thing, right? There's a descriptive part of climate change where some of the predictions for the future and accounting for today is just uncertain. We don't know exactly what's going to happen or exactly what is happening. But there's also a normative aspect to this uncertainty. We're not quite sure what our obligations, what our relationships, what our responsibilities might be in an uncertain world. And we're not quite sure how to account for our values when facing uncertainty. So to help Simona and I unpack this, we're going to go back to my excursion on the glacier in Alaska with Roman Dial. We're also going to hear an interview Simona did with New Yorker staff writer and author Elizabeth Colbert.
But first, together, we're going to talk with Emma Maris. Emma's the author of two books and a writer who's been published in a ton of places like National Geographic, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Wired. The list goes on. And she also has a lot to say about uncertainty.
We've been talking a lot about how climate change is an inherently uncertain problem.
Right.
And there's sort of a couple different ways we could try to address uncertainty. One, we could learn more and get more certain, or we could learn how to deal with uncertainty, right? Those are sort of the two paths.
Or both.
Or both, in some combination. So we wanted to get your sort of big picture take on if you think we need more information right now, because that seems to be what a lot of the climate change conversation focuses on. Let's learn more. Let's get more stats, more figures, more precise. But we're still not doing a lot of the stuff that maybe we need to do, even as we learn more.
Yeah, yeah. We don't need to learn anything more at this point. I mean, that's not true. Certain people in certain roles in society that definitely need to learn more, you know, people who are working on particular technological problems, people trying to get us carbon neutral air flight, you know, certain issues like that. But for most of us who are not, I don't know, aviation engineers or city planners or somebody who's making a lot of really technical decisions on a day-to-day basis, we have enough information. In fact, when the most recent IPCC report came out, my advice to people who are already engaged in climate change was not to read it, because it was just going to send everybody spiraling. And the basics are the same. The planet is warming. It's because of fossil fuels. We need to stop burning fossil fuels. The end. I mean, it's not actually that complicated. So I think that most of us are probably in a place where additional information about the problem is not helpful, actually, because we understand it. Now, additional information about potential solutions, new approaches, mitigation, adaptation, all that stuff. Like, I read those articles. I would recommend people read those articles. But a new thing about a glacier melting or a new IPCC report, if you think that it's going to make you feel shitty, if you think that reading this, you know, the latest article about the problem, about the crisis, is going to shut you down so you're less likely to do anything, then don't read it.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought up the IPCC report, because I was going to ask you if you think this is actually a different focus, or if this is still like the problem issue that maybe we don't need to talk about anymore, which is, yeah, we don't need to keep stacking on the pile, like, you know, necessarily more information about glaciers. But we do want to talk about the problem of political inaction. And so whether or not you think there ought to be more focus, you know, on the social science stuff or on the norm stuff and on the social problem, and if that's really where a redistributed focus ought to be, it seems like this IPCC report started to dabble in that, but still the conversation's not on that. So
that's a good point. I mean, insofar as the new information is about how to shift political power or how to shift action, either psychological stuff, political stuff, all this. I mean, the problem, right? I said the problem is fossil fuels. The problem is people burning fossil fuels. Almost every single environmental problem, in fact, all environmental problems are human behavior issues. They're not about the science of the non-human world. They're about the way that human beings interact with it. So I think paying attention to all that new research and development and focusing on that aspect is really important. But I think that for your average citizen, if you have either the mental bandwidth or the time in your schedule for X amount of climate change hours, let's say 2 hours a week before your brain is fried or you run out of time and you need to pick up the kids from school, whatever, I would spend 90% of that 2 hours a week on action, on trying to change things, and, you know, a little bit on education and so on. But it really is the time for action.
Well, so one of the problems, I guess, that sometimes people face when trying to move to action is that they say we don't know enough, even if we do, right? People will say, well, there is this sort of probabilistic presentation of the problem. Well, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. Well, we're not sure exactly how the world's going to unfold. So if we don't need more information, then what do you think the strategies are for moving towards action in the face of those uncertainties?
Well, I think there's you got to divide people who call for more information into the good faith people and the bad faith people. For the good faith people, you know, I'd say, yes, indeed. You know, from where we stand in time, there's a kind of a cone of possibilities radiating out. And the further forward we get in time, the larger that cone of possibilities is. And for any given parts per billion of carbon, there's better and worse possible futures. But there's one very simple relationship, and that is the more, greenhouse gases are in the atmosphere, the worse things are. And so although there's many, many uncertainties about how it will play out in any given location and at any given time for any given system, hydrological, or, you know, for the cities, for the storms, the basic central relationship, more emissions equals shittier futures, is well understood. And so if we were already doing a lot about climate change politically, if there was a robust policy response and we were arguing on the margins about whether we should be investing more in electrification or more in, fire mitigation in the West, then that would be a conversation that maybe we would need a lot of more technical expertise. But we're still at a very basic place in terms of our response is just wildly incommensurate with what we need to be doing. And so it doesn't, the sort of level of understanding that we need to call for a much more robust response is there. We have the data to call for that. For the bad faith actors, I don't talk to bad faith actors anymore. There's no point. Just ignore them and get them out of power. If we just had a king who cared about climate change, they could get a lot accomplished very quickly because the technologies are not that complicated either, right? Like, fixing democracy, fixing structural inequities is legitimately harder than fixing climate change.
Sounds way harder.
It's way harder. But unless you have a king and a robot that eats climate change, then I don't see how you do it without fixing the structures. So yeah, to the communications point, I mean, if I'm a physicist and my sort of area of expertise is the actual science of how climate change works, and I want to tell people about that and make that clear to them, then Godspeed, go do that. That's fine. There likely still are some people who don't understand it at that level, and maybe that would help them. I don't actually think that explaining the the sort of social dimensions of climate change is that much harder than explaining the physics of climate change. Look, greenhouse gases are like a blanket. They're making us hot. 68% of people give a shit about this problem. If they had power, we would already be doing something about it. Look, I just explained both halves of it in like two sentences. It's not that hard.
Well, and so when if we say we don't need more information because we know this is a problem, but we need to engage in problem solving more actively, the next question is the question of, okay, like how do we engage in problem solving? And a lot of people do want to look to the past as a baseline for all of our goals. And one of the things that's really a theme, Emma, in your writing is that, well, we don't need to do that for a whole bunch of reasons.
The past is really useful data. I'm a huge fan of environmental history and what we can learn from there and how that can frame our what we want for the future. But recreating the past as a full reconstruction restoration project, I agree. Yeah. I don't think that's workable.
I think 100% right. I think the challenge then is how do we use the past to inform these sort of novel goals for the world that we want to take responsibility for and have all these sort of obligations to.
Yeah. So now we're shifting a little bit from climate change as sort of like this pure heating phenomenon that we weren't being very specific about the, you know, and a lot of the risks and potential negative consequences are that we think about from a justice framework are for human communities, like cities flooding, heat waves, you know, cities burning, people's homes burning down. And then when we start talking about historical baselines and looking to the past, we shift over a little bit to a more of an ecological restoration conversation. You know, what do we want to preserve? What, when we say we want to save nature, what are we talking about? And that is something that I have done a ton of work on throughout my career. And something that I've been kind of perpetually surprised by is the fact that the people who are often most focused on saving nature or doing ecological work are often politically liberal. And yet the project of restoration or sort of preservation is often deeply conservative in the sort of non-political sense, but in the sense of just being traditionalist, backward-looking, very much informed by the notion that what is in the past is superior to what's in the present, and not want and being very averse to any kind of novelty or change. And that's interesting to me because it seems like a mismatch, just sort of like, you know, I mean, it's often the people who are the most pro-immigrant and the very same people who went down to the airports when Trump did the ban on immigration from those countries with signs are the ones who are the ripping out non-native species from public parks with like passionate zeal. So there's a weird mismatch there that has always intrigued me and always interested me because I tend to think that, you know, hallmarks of sort of liberal thought include being more comfortable with change and novelty and being less purist. And I bring that to my nature thinking too. I think that purism has held back the conservation movement and made us obsessed with recreating moments in history that are usually totally human history moments, usually based on moments of colonization. And we've sort of convinced ourselves that this is a scientific goal when it's really very clearly a cultural goal. But I think that's changing. You know, I think in the years since my first book came out, there's been a wide-ranging conservation conversation about what the goal should be. And I think that just as there's a generational divide in climate change discussion, I think there's also a generational divide in the conservation restoration discussion. And many younger people are realizing that partly due to climate change, but also due to just understanding the long, complex, and non-uniform histories of ecosystems, that you can't, science doesn't provide you a goal. And so they're coming up with much more interesting ways to set goals that are definitely not anything goes, that are definitely not just let's build a big box store. Some people think that if you let go of that historical goal, then what you're left with is building a parking lot is ethically equivalent to restoring a forest. And that is not the case.
You know, we're all trying to thread this line, all of us that work on this sort of stuff, between the sort of, you know, resisting doomism because doomism is the recipe for inaction and resisting idealistic hope. So wanting to find something that's more about, you know, response ability, right? Or gritty hope or that sort of like maybe pulling from action and there's like a source of empowerment there. Did it sort of like emerge with just your personally trying to thread these things, or was it also just, I mean, for me, it's like encountering students and young people all the time who come out of class and just like are looking to me for some sort of starting point or sense of empowerment, right?
Yeah, very much that. I mean, I remember when it was like 2011 that I was wanting a new handbag, and I spent like 4 hours on the internet trying to find like the most eco-friendly possible handbag. And then I was like, wow, I could have gone to a city council meeting with that 4 hours and like fought for denser zoning, and that would have made a much bit. And so that was like my kind of aha moment, but it was a long time ago now. And so then for many years, I've seen people sort of be stuck in that green consumer rut. Where that's, I mean, all those practices are lovely, but like just kind of stuck in that individual mode. And the more kind of activist I got, the more I missed those people. I'd hang out with these people socially, and they'd be very much very green, very worried about climate change. And then I'd be like, hey, come down to the, you know, we're having a meeting about this pipeline they want to build. And they would be like, well, I can't because I'm making yogurt. And I'd be like...
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And I'd be like,
that's so funny.
I totally know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I remember telling some mom friend of mine, like, it's okay to feed your kids a frozen pizza once a month so you can go to the climate change meeting.
Right, right.
And that was one seed. And then just, as you say, you know, talking to people who feel like they just don't know what the first step is or what they can do or how to plug in, and they're just feeling overwhelmed. And like, we're all feeling overwhelmed.
Right.
That's so totally natural.
Well, it's nice because it sounds like you're dislodging, again, like this fixation on purity and this fixation on what the trade-offs are, right? So I think that purity considerations or how good can I be, or the like whether my ethics is super compromised if I give the kid the Go-Gurt, right, instead of my homemade, right, like milked
I think this gets back to our very, like, exactly where we started, that in the face of uncertainty, maybe one of the strategies we need is that, like, people need to stop trying to optimize.
100%. And it took me so many years to, Alex, to, like, have that realization that you just verbalized. In fact, I'm still trying to talk myself out of trying to optimize, because the quest for the optimal leads to paralysis. The perfect becomes the enemy of the good. The only way to get through this is just to throw ourselves at it and figure it out as we do it.
And do it together with others, right?
Yes,
and negotiate
exactly
all the messiness that comes with that.
The metaphor that I've been using is imagine that you're trying to get like a huge wad of like sticks and branches through a doorway, right? So like you could take a 3D picture of the stick structure and then like analyze it and then like have a computer algorithm to figure out like which stick to move first. And then, or like you could get like five guys and you could all shove on it at the same time and then it would go through. And like, that's kind of the visual image that I have about where we are and what we need to be doing. Like, get in there and shove.
I really appreciate Emma's take on how we just can't be so concerned with optimizing. We have to be more concerned with action.
Right. And that's an issue about knowledge and information, right? So it is important to be actually, you know, able to have some information to act, but you don't want needing to accumulate more information as being a barrier to action, right? And that's often what optimizing is.
I see what you did there. You made it about uncertainty.
I did.
Yeah, no, honestly, it's a call for action in the face of uncertainty. Right.
Right. Right.
It doesn't matter if you know everything. You don't need to know everything to know that you have to do something.
Or also that more information about a certain kind of thing may actually be not just detrimental to action, but also unnecessary. So maybe things that we need to learn to lean into more in terms of what we need to know is how to work together. Right. What kinds of points of collaboration and organizing and solidarity making can happen. But I think there is these kinds of like relational and, you know, other kinds of, I guess, skills and other kinds of knowledge that maybe we ought to be focusing on that doesn't seem explicitly like climate information, but figuring out how to work together is itself, you know, a climate kind of, you know, set of actions or inquiry or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, there's some information that's useful. The information, like maybe it seems like what Emma was trying to share with us was a perspective that descriptive uncertainty matters when it impacts normative uncertainty. We don't need to solve for the last decimal point just to solve for the last decimal point. We need to know more when it helps us unpack what we actually owe to each other with regard to climate change and uncertain futures, right? But we don't need, we don't just need more information to have more information. Right? We shouldn't let that be a barrier to action. So next, we're going to play an interview that you did, Simona, with Elizabeth Colbert.
Yeah, that's right. So just a quick note here. I had to actually like grab Elizabeth in a bit of a pinch. She was here at a conference at Princeton University, and it was pretty noisy. I recorded it on my phone. So sorry in advance for any bad audio. It's a little messy, but I thought it was important to get her on. And, you know, I should probably not assume everyone knows who Elizabeth Colbert is. So Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's also the author of several books, including most recently Under a White Sky and her Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. So to kick things off, I asked her basically the same first question that we prompted Emma with. I'm just wondering, in terms of like the information gap versus the amount of evidence, it seems, I'm just wondering if you feel like there needs to be sort of this distributed energy now to really having that kind of in a focus, as opposed to continuing to pile on evidence, right? That at this point, it doesn't seem like we need further convincing, right, about the degree to which, you know.
Well, I think once again, from a journalist perspective, I'll be frank and say all of these conversations seem to be taking place in some pretty weird space where, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, coal plants are still going up.
Right.
People are buying, you know, SUV sales are up. You know, I mean, the crazy ways in which are, I mean, if you ask me what more focus should be on, I would say more focus should be on and a national level. I'm just going to talk about a national level right now because international becomes head spinning.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of policies in place in the U.S. that are completely counterproductive.
Yeah.
And we should be looking at those and trying to unravel them as best we can. Now, the political hurdles are immense, but, you know, you can talk until you're blue in the face. You can talk about, you know, 1.5 versus 2.
Right.
You can talk about nationally, you know, determined commitments. You can talk about carbon removal. You can talk about all these things. But, you know, the facts on the ground are really bad.
Yeah.
They're very bad. We're continuing to move in the wrong direction. Not just like we're not really making progress. We're actually making, you know, negative progress. So I think that everyone keeps having conversations among themselves. So academics have conversations among themselves, environmentalists have conversations among themselves. And the politics of this country, I think, get worse and worse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, when you're on the losing side of something, you know, there tends to be a lot of pointing, finger pointing, this is what went wrong, this is what, if only we could communicate better, if only we would do this better, if only the press would do this, if only blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the fact of the matter is our politics are, you know, profoundly broken, and if not a majority of people, you know, just enough to control the Senate, enough to control the House, will vote in ways that, you know, certainly don't take climate change into account, let's say, and quite the reverse. And, you know, who's to blame for that? Give up.
Same. And, you know, this episode that we're focusing on is going to be sort of about the general concept of uncertainty. And I was just wondering, and maybe this is like from a personal all the way to like a more macro level, how you see that we're handling some of these larger questions about uncertainty, how you think we ought to, who the we even is in this question is right ambiguous, how you manage in your work to sort of engage with this issue of uncertainty. Because like I said, you know, in some sense, we have a lot of knowledge, right? And in a lot of cases, there are these kind of open questions and sort of how we make plans in light of that, both an information gap, but also given the information that we do have. So I'm just wondering how you feel entangled with this idea of uncertainty.
I mean, the good part is, I suppose the good news is there's a certain amount of uncertainty. And the bad news is that there's a certain amount of uncertainty. And, you know, I think that it's just yet another reason, really, why this is such a difficult issue, political issue, mm-hmm. to deal with, because you cannot, you know, sort of guarantee people, you know, and I think you can say, well, if we do this, if we do X, you know, Y will happen, because there is a very dramatic range of uncertainty. And not only, you know, I mean, there's so many, you know, there's time lags built in, there's uncertainties on the time lags, right. There's uncertainties on the, you know, there are error bars. And, you know, so I think that there's a tangle that, you know, is just the tangle of reality, I suppose, where, you know, people keep saying, well, this is a disastrous threshold to cross. We're going to cross that disastrous threshold, and then what happens? And so, you know, we've gotten ourselves into a little bit, we, and I use that term very loosely too, mm-hmm. of a bind. You know, what do you say when once disaster, you know, okay, yeah. This is disaster. Well, you know, we've guaranteed disaster for our kids, for our grandkids.
Yeah, what threshold and where,
yeah,
it's built in.
And the time scales here, I think, are also really hard for people to deal with. We're yeah. used to dealing with things in a, you know, we're a very instant gratification society, and something mm-hmm. that happens even next year. Now, if you're talking about something, the impacts of which, you know, will not be fully felt for 30 years, yeah. and the real ramifications of which may last thousands of years, you know, we've proven ourselves just completely incapable of dealing with that. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we're really coming up against the limits of our ability as a species and as a civilization to grapple with what we've set in motion. We just are not capable of it, apparently.
What stood out to me that I'm actually curious, like how you felt in person, was that she seems way more pessimistic about our ability to deal with uncertainty.
Right. So I was actually really surprised, right, because I read a lot of her work, and she's been, you know, in this space for a really long time. And she is somewhat optimistic about a range of, you know, some technological innovations and surprisingly some aspects of geoengineering. But in general, her somewhat of a pessimism of being able to like act and to act quick enough and to scale, she seemed to be like increasingly pessimistic about.
I mean, she came across to me like much more concerned about uncertainty as a political issue than Emma did. And it seemed like Elizabeth Colbert is much more worried that uncertainty is just going to create a kind of paralysis. And that overcoming that is a really big lift.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like maybe that Elizabeth Colbert thinks that, and this was just my take on the interview, that, well, the best way to avoid uncertainty is to avoid uncertainty. Is that the more we know, the more we constrain uncertainty as a problem, and that really is a incredibly powerful way of overcoming this incredibly challenging problem.
So let's return to Alex's conversation with Roman Dial on the glacier in South Central Alaska.
So the maps would say that we should be walking or skiing on a glacier, but there was no ice anymore, and the glacier was way up valley. And then more practically, some of the places where I've undertaken research on glaciers are much more difficult to get to now. So one of my collaborators hiked up to the Milk Glacier where we are, and I think in 2000 or 2001, and he found ice worms here. And ice worms are these little relatives of the earthworm. They look like a little earthworm under a microscope, a little black earthworm, and their organs are even black. Their whole being is black so that they can absorb any light and help warm them up. And they actually only live on glaciers. And ironically, you can kill an ice worm by freezing it. So if we were to pick up these little inch-long black earthwormy looking things, they look like a string when you see them on the glacier. They only come out at night because otherwise they'll overheat, I guess. But if you were to pick them up and collect them and put them in a, like a, you know, Ziploc bag of snow and take them home and put them in your freezer, the freezer will kill them overnight. On the other hand, if you put them in the Ziploc bag in your refrigerator, in a bowl or whatever, you could keep them there for a year or more, for years. And you probably wouldn't even have to ever give them any food if they had that original snow that you collected them with. They die at about 25 degrees Fahrenheit. So the interesting and ironic thing about ice worms is they are sensitive to the cold. And here on the Milk Glacier, where 20, 25 years ago there were ice worms, now there are no ice worms. And the reason there's no ice worms is all of the snow that falls on this glacier in the winter melts all the way back to the top of the ridge between this glacier and the next glacier, and it leaves all the ice worms exposed to the cold temperatures that come in September, when we have these really clear nights and no snow has fallen yet, and they're on the ice, and they encounter temperatures that are lethal to them. So the ice worm has gone extinct on this glacier, ironically, because the climate change has left them vulnerable to getting too cold.
Because there's too much ice. There's not enough snow anymore.
There's not enough snow and there's too much ice.
So for this episode, we've been talking to lots of folks about uncertainty. One of the things that strikes me about how we talk about climate change as a society is that often we lean on uncertainty as a reason not to do stuff. So we say, like, there's uncertainty in climate models, or there's uncertainty in policy approaches, or we don't know what's really going to happen, so we need to study it more. So as folks that study environmental change, I'm curious how you think new information can help solve that problem, and if it can solve that problem. So do we need more information, and how does new information and more information help get over that sort of hurdle?
I would say that we do need more information. So, for example, in the old IPCC reports, they report that boreal forest, you know, which is the northern forest in North America and Europe or Eurasia, that we typically think of as covering Alaska and Canada and Siberia, where the pine trees and the spruce trees are, and beyond the boreal forest is the tundra. And the IPCC report conjectures through modeling that the boreal forest is going to advance forward into the tundra. And by doing that, it's going to expand the boreal forest, and it has its own consequences. and yet, this is not happening. They think that it should be, like, maybe by the end of this century, that forest should be, you know, 100 kilometers north. But the fact of the matter is the climate is changing. It seems to be changing faster than the forest can keep up. You know, the tree can only move so far. A seed can only blow so far away from its parent. And then, you know, it's going to take a spruce tree 30 years to mature, to be the age where it can produce its own cone. So the average distance that a seed falls from a parent, a spruce tree, is about 150 feet. So we're talking, you know, it's going to go 150 feet 1 year, then it's going to take 30 years to go another 150 feet. That's how fast the forest is going to go. So it's, you know, what, 150 feet divided by 30 is like 5 feet a year. I mean, that's a very slow rate.
Yep.
And so nobody has really reported trees moving as fast as they apparently moved at the end of the last ice age, when they moved, maybe they moved a few miles a decade, you know?
And so should that make us more worried? Like, because because investigating environmental change can help us understand ways that we're, in fact, underestimating those changes.
Right, yeah.
Should we be more concerned or more compelled to act?
Yes, I think some people would say yes. I'm a little bit ambivalent on the fact myself. But some people would definitely say yes, because the idea is, if the boreal forest holds most of the carbon in the world in some sense, you know, like terrestrial carbon, and it doesn't hold it in the trees because the trees are kind of stunted and small. It holds it in the soils.
Yeah.
So there's enormous quantities of of carbon in these soils. And so if the boreal forest were to advance into the tundra, then you know, hopefully they would capture more carbon and thereby actually pull carbon out of the atmosphere and slow down warming. I mean, that's the negative feedback.
Yep.
Other people would suggest, and this is you asked about uncertainty. This is a big issue. This is a very uncertain topic. Other people have gone out and measured that what happens is as these forests move forward, where they have found new forests or new trees, the decomposition that's happening in the tundra is releasing more carbon dioxide than is being captured by the forest. But these experiments haven't gone on long enough to get a forest, because these boreal forests, what they'll actually do once they get to be like 100 years old, then they're tall and they develop moss in their understory because they're so shaded. And then permafrost actually is formed.
Yeah.
And so the time scale, that's where all this, the most uncertainty is in the time scale of things. I mean, most of the scientific studies are like a 4-year PhD, and that's how long you can get something funded. And what we're talking about here are changes that, you know, the generation of a tree is 30 years. So you can only get a couple of generations in somebody's lifetime.
Sure. Or the generation of a forest could be 300 years.
It could be 300 years, exactly. So we've seen these hemlocks and spruce trees that have colonized this moraine where ice was certainly present 100 years ago and possibly present 50 years ago. And now there are trees growing there. But it's going to be a long time before it's forest. So how fast things are going to move, there's a lot of uncertainty in that. And we're always going to have to be observing and replanting.
I'm curious, as someone who seeks out places where there is a high amount of uncertainty in travel, in what's around the corner, in, you know, is there a bear? Can we cross the river here? Is there a crevasse over there? Whatever it is. Is some of the appeal that sort of the outdoors provides that we have sort of too predictable of a life outside of that?
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. I do like, I never really thought about that, but maybe I am an unpredictability junkie.
Yeah.
You know, I do, I mean, I can plan things, but I kind of, when things, you know, when they're more interesting, when it's a problem to solve.
Yeah.
And I do like science. I like doing field science because I don't think we do know everything that's going on. And there's a, you know, there's like this sort of, it's unlimited the amount of new information you can peel out of nature. It just comes down to what's important at the time. So, yeah, I love the unpredictability of nature. I guess I do like, I like it being unpredictable, but I want to find a solution to it.
So do any stories come to mind of trips where unpredictability posed an unusual challenge that was overcome?
Well, I don't think I have any memorable trips that weren't unpredictable in some way, right? Because that's how we learn, like when something happens that you're not expecting.
Yeah.
And then you deal with it.
So, Alex, what's your takeaway from that adventure that you had with Roman?
One of the things that was super interesting to me was the sort of changes on the landscape that Roman noticed. This particular glacier is actually a spot that I've been to quite a bit recently, but Roman hadn't. And so heading in, looking at where trees were establishing and how quickly the glacier was receding, I was confronted with an interesting baseline problem, where what was normal to me in seeing this place in the last few years was much more extreme to Roman, who's been exploring these mountains for many decades, right? And has a much broader personal experience with the change in that place. So that was really interesting to see. Now, that's not exactly about uncertainty, but in some ways, it shows how much we already know, right? It shows what part of the problem isn't uncertain, and the extent to which we have a pretty clear picture of a lot of climate change. We might not know exactly where the next tree is going to grow or how it's going to move or exactly where the glacier is going to recede to, but we do know that there's massive changes in this landscape already. I mean, I think Roman is far more positive about uncertainty than either Emma or Elizabeth were in our conversations with them, right? I think that while Emma Maris saw some political opportunity and uncertainty, and Elizabeth Colbert sort of maybe suggested that we should be constraining uncertainty, I think Roman, in many ways, conveyed this view of uncertainty as just part of the human condition and part of nature in a way that's not just unavoidable, but really powerful. And that uncertainty itself can teach us a lesson. And that grappling with uncertainty itself is something that can help us sort of find novel solutions that themselves might be uncertain.
So are you saying going out and experiencing some of the unpredictability of nature, aka touching grass, might be good for us as philosophers as well?
Let's. I think we got to touch grass. Yeah. absolutely. I think getting out in it is one way that we can do a much better job of
reasoning through these things.
reasoning through these and of making sure that theory can help guide action and be informed by the world as it is.
Thanks so much for listening to the first episode of A Hostile Climate. The podcast is hosted by me, Simona Capizani.
And me, Alex Lee.
And our show is produced and edited by Cody Nelson.
Special thanks this week to Naima Raza, Olivia Frankie, Best Case Studios, Suzanne Myers, Adam Pincus, Ashley Warren, and the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org.
Please make sure you're subscribed on the podcast platform of your choice. If you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating and tell a friend.